And the easiest analogy for most crowds is to say that if you've heard of CERN and what they do to particle physics, and our organisation is like that, but for molecular biology. So it's a topic which is quite expensive to do research in, where a number of countries, in our case initially 11 or 12, now up to 27, decided it was cost effective to collaborate, set up an institute that would do certain kinds of science collaboratively, and scientists come in and leave over the years and work there. And we're now on 6 sites spread over 5 different countries, doing different aspects of molecular biology. The headquarters is in Heidelberg in Germany, and 25 years ago they realised they were going to run out of space to do the computational biology that they had kind of accidentally become leaders in, which was the field of storing information about, well, originally proteins, but DNA and proteins and associated sources of data which needed archiving, and they accidentally become one of the global centres for doing that, and this rapidly grew as the reliance on computers and the use of computers grew in molecular biology, and as the data started rolling in faster and faster, and they kind of put it open to tender, and a group based in Cambridge won the bid to establish our institute as a new outpost of European Molecular Biology Laboratory on the same site in Hinxton, just south of Sawston, so 15 miles from here, to the south of here. And we're on the same site as the Wellcome Trust's Sanger Institute, now Wellcome Trust, the Sanger Institute, originally the Sanger Centre, which they worked to establish at pretty much the same time as their contribution to the sequencing of the first human genome. And that was, as it were, the winning bid. The Wellcome Trust is technically is our landlord. We pay them some tiny rent. They own the building. That's the original building. My office is, can you do it, Anna? You know, that one, about there. Anna's office is one down. And that's our original building, and then this thing you can't quite see is our extension. I have another building, and now I have another building, and we're in an area of science which we normally describe it as a kind of infinite demand for people to know how to process this kind of data. And so even in times when other sciences might be struggling, we're pretty well funded. And so there's two aspects to the work the Institute does, and one is to be one of, I'm going to say, the two main global repositories of molecular biology data. If there were Japanese people in the room, I would have to say three, but there aren't, so we can admit that they're not as important as the other two. So it's us on behalf of Europe and the world, because obviously with the internet now, you can't do it just for Europe, but our funding is primarily from Europe, and the Americans through the National Institutes of Health. The other big player in this game, and we don't really compete. I mean, the data is all the same, and we share all huge amounts of data. It's a very open form of science. Most areas of molecular biology, you can't, as an academic researcher, you can't publish your research unless you make the raw data available through public databases, and that's essentially enforced by the policy of journals. It's always people that find a way out, but largely all the data is all the publicly funded data. And so that's sent to us over the internet, and we organise it, cross-reference all sorts of different bits. You'll see another slide in a minute that gives a kind of visual aid to understand that, how much of that goes on, and offer that data back to the world. And that's three-quarters of the people that work at our institute are involved in that side of things, and the remainder are researchers who do stuff with that data. And it's a very deliberate policy to have both with what we call the service side of data storing and provision and the usage side, so researchers on the same side, because they both benefit from being near the other. And so I'm there as initially I was appointed in 2002 to run a research group, and mostly I study evolution, the way genomes change over large time scales, and what we can learn about evolution and what predictions we can make about the future from that. But the stats, most are related to the service provision, and actually nowadays, someone was asking me about how much data center storage we have, And I didn't update this slide, but I did recently look at a more up-to-date set of slides, and in fact it's now over 200 petabytes. So we're a pretty serious data center, or we don't actually hold it on site, we go commercially, but we require a serious data center. The 38 million requests, that means in one form or another, so that's either people clicking on want something from the website, but that doesn't account for 38 million, and the number actually now is over 60 million per day, but mostly those will be computational requests. So someone's written a computer program that might be sitting there and 100 times a minute querying our databases for data. So we are, the computers are responding to over 60 million requests per day to get that information. We either give raw data or we do some kind of compute at the request of others, and that's 140 million compute jobs. That's in a year, that was a couple of years ago. And we try and keep some idea, though GDPR makes it harder to do this, but we try and keep, or to do it legally, we try and keep some track of how many different people are using the data, and it's very hard to track the people, but you can track the IDs of the computers, and we get something like 3.3 million different computers are involved in querying. So we spend a lot of time thinking about large quantities of biology data, and we have a load of different databases for different forms of the data, DNA, whole genome sequences, partial genome sequences, the descriptions of proteins, the three-dimensional structures of proteins, the databases on the metabolic pathways of which proteins interact with which other proteins and what products of that are, and all these sorts of things. And the graph on the left is what we use to describe that to our funders, mostly to explain why they should keep on funding us. And it's a bit hard to see, but the colours and the writing are different major databases or collections of databases. So each one will be doing some, be relevant, most relevant to some particular area of medical biology. And the coloured stuff in the middle is, oh, so that's the block. And then within each block, each little smaller thing that you can't quite see will be a different aspect of that, a different form of the data relevant to what they need to store in each database. And then the coloured lines or bands are indicating where databases kind of cross-reference each other. And we use that to try and explain. We've been using this one more when we're trying to recruit programmers, because we find it difficult to recruit top-class programmers, and we feel it's a lack of awareness of the kind of work people will be doing if they came to work for a research, an international research institute instead of a bank or something. And we like to draw it this way, and then we kind of say, you can almost think of like each element of this is like a different startup company. There's 10 or so people work on a very specific project that links some of these parts of databases together or maintains a suite of databases. And we've now started describing ourselves as being a bit like 60 different startup companies, each with its own exciting computing project. Anyone want to look at that? Program for us. And it doesn't matter what these are graphs of how big the databases are. All that matters is that there's quite a few of them, and the time is on a linear scale on the x-axis, but the size of the database, whatever you're measuring it in, it's gigabytes about here, is on a logarithmic scale. So anything that goes up in approximately a straight line is exponentially increasing. And you can usually work out which one. If I was better at this, you'd know which ones were which by when the jumps occur, because that would be related to a change in the technology. So I should at least try and do one. But the blue one is going to be kind of raw DNA sequence. And then the big jump around 2008-09 was a change of technology, that there was a big move from relatively old, what we now call old technology, 10 years ago. And this is when a company called Illumina, who was set up, parts of it came out of the University of Cambridge, and they were based in Great Chesterfield, which is just down the road from us, south of Sawston, and they started selling their sequencing devices here somewhere, and they very quickly kind of started taking over the market, and they're clearly the market leader still, and everyone can suddenly start sequencing large parts of genomes or complete genomes for a fraction of the cost of what they used to be able to do before. And that just is all data. It just is all exponentially, more or less exponentially increasing. amounts of data which we are meant to store. And as some people know, our funding does not increase exponentially this time, strangely. So we have to see what we can do about that. So we are always on the lookout for interesting ways of storing data. And there have been times, including that here, when we were seriously worried about whether we could keep on storing all the data people wanted to send to us, whether we could afford to do that. In fact, things are okay. There's been some improvements in the way the data is compressed. As you can see, you know, things, that there are jumps, but to be honest, they don't always continue as straight lines. They're slightly below exponential growth with the odd jump, so it's not too bad. So we're okay at the moment, but we were very worried in 2011. So the story goes that I and my colleagues were having a meeting in Hamburg in this bar, though we didn't take the photo at the time, and we'd had a day of meetings about whether we could keep, whether as an institute we could afford to continue to store all the data, or whether we would have to start putting constraints on what we stored. It had been we really started worrying about it because the American analogue of us had recently made announcements that they were going to stop accepting data from some of the databases, and if you wanted that stored, you have to do it yourself. Which is maybe feasible, but makes sharing it much, much harder, because now in the future other researchers would need to go to 10 or 100 different people to ask for the data instead of having a central place to get it. And we were just talking about whether there were other ways of storing data that might be cost effective than hard disks and the cooling systems you need to go with them and the electricity to drive all of that. Light bulb moment, and the light bulb moment was remembering that all my rest of my research life up until then had been studying evolution. So this is here's all of the evolution of all life in one slide picture. There's some animals, that part of the tree of all living organisms. There's a little "you are here" red arrow, doesn't show up very well. Humans are somewhere in there. We're not very important really in the big scheme of things. There's a lot more fungi, bacteria, than there are different animals. Plus, this is very biased because we're a lot more interested in animals, so we've done a much better job of sampling out here. We know basically all the animals there are. There's a lot of beetles we haven't worked out yet, but we've got a pretty good idea of what all the animals are. We've got virtually no idea of what all the bacteria emerges and things like that. We're discovering more and more. That's a huge small. But through all the 3.5 billion years things have been alive, they have been passing on their information about how you make their cells and what you do through their DNA. You need basically nothing else from one generation to the next than the DNA. So despite the fact that I've been studying this all my life and using comparison of the DNA sequences to see how they had changed over evolutionary timescales, it hadn't occurred to me that this was just information storage medium.
So I suppose that thing in the middle, Nick, that's the sort of source of all life.
Yeah, it's a bit hypothetical, right? What exactly it would be at that point, but yes. And it's probably, I mean, way back in the middle, it's barely even, I mean, in theory, it's barely even a cellular organism at all. It's just some bits of DNA floating around in the primordial soup. But that DNA can interact with other bits of DNA. Eventually it found a way of packaging itself inside the cell, and the cells found a way of getting energy from their surroundings, and they found ways of clumping together so they became multicellular organisms. So ultimately you end up with all the things around the outside. If you have the wrong type of scientific background, you say, and eventually we ascended to being humans, but you don't think of it that way. Yeah, so 3.5 billion years, that was information being passed from cell to cell, generation to generation, through this expanding, diversifying lineage of everything that's ever alive. And this is the DNA that's in there that's doing this information to them, so that anyone doesn't know. DNA is a chemical molecule. It's not in itself alive in any sense, it's just a bit of chemistry. It just happens to be a bit of chemistry that inside a cell has a very particular meaning and enables the cell to function, processes go on that process the DNA in different ways and life happens. And so there are four molecules that form the elements of DNA. Cytosine, guanine, adenine, thymine, better known by the letters CGANT. There's a bit of colour coding going on that I'm trying to stick to. And they will join together in a chain, and you can put them in any order in that. They will stick together in any order in that chain, appropriately reacted. And that chain is very stable, and it can also be exceedingly long. You can have a chain of millions and millions of those elements, and it remains very stable. It does all sorts of things. It wraps up on itself, and it forms forms, and it does all, you know, to protect the structure inside the cell, and it's incredibly small. So this is the famous double helix. So here you have a chain and another chain that goes, in fact, in the other direction, and the structure is such that they will bind to each other in a helix. But as long as the molecule on one side has its appropriate complementary pair molecule on the other side. So if you have an A on one side, the other one, you need a T on the other side. If you have a C on one side, you need a G on the other side. And given that, they will beautifully form exactly the right shape and form a helix. And this is Watson and Crick and Franklin's famous helix structure. Each link down this, like a chain or a ladder, is 0.4 nanometers or 4 angstroms. I don't even know what an angstrom is. I don't know how you're meant to imagine what an angstrom is, but it's smaller than anything you can sensibly think of is how small it is. And because of the rule that the pairing requires the right bases, they're called mononucleotides, to match up, that once you know one side of the helix, the other side, you've got no choice. So although it's famous for the helix structure, and it's very important for the way copies are made when cells split and pass DNA copies to the offspring cells, in fact, all the information in it is in one or the other. If you know one, you know what the other one must be. So the information, you can just think of it, you need to imagine one of the two strands. So there's a picture of one of the two strands. And in fact, all the information is, you don't need to know the structure. We know the structure deals with itself, chemistry can cope. And all you need to record, all the databases and genomes are full of, is series of letters that are either A, C, G, or T in whatever the appropriate sequence is. And so genome sequencing is getting DNA out of a living organism and putting it in a machine that's able to somehow look at, in some sense, the tiny molecules and report back to you what the sequence of the molecules is. And typically they're stored in a very human readable form on the computers, which is why it's somewhat inefficient, because you could compress it much better. But it's nice to be able to have a quick look and see what's in there sometimes. So that's how information, in a sense, is stored in DNA. And we wondered about a system where we would store information, not biological information, not the rules or whatever they are that make a cell alive, but other information that we would determine and we would decide, could we store it in DNA? Could we get it back? Could it function as an information storage system? And what you need for an information storage system is the ability to write your information into your medium, and you need to be able to read it back from your medium, and you need some code or language of how you store the information you want inside that medium. And what we thought and realised when we were at the bar in Hamburg was that actually now, due to genome and technology and medical research, we had two of those components. We had the writing and the reading, we didn't have a language. But we imagined we could come up with one, and eventually we did. So this is what DNA writing looks like. Mostly it's done in facilities that look like the two big pictures. And it's come out of the market leader for a long time was a company called Agilent, which came out of Hewlett-Packard, HP, and was spun off from their inkjet printer division. And instead of doing inkjet printing of text or pictures where you use different coloured inks and you fire them very accurately onto spots on usually a piece of paper and you blend different coloured inks and they mix and they make the colour you need at that spot. Almost the same technology is used, but at each spot you build a chain of DNA and you do it not by just mixing together chemicals but adding them successively. So that at each stage you add the next molecule you need on an ever-growing chain of DNA. And they would do this on typically glass slides, where they could do maybe something like a million addressable spots on something approximately that size. And on each spot, they make fragments of DNA by spraying it with appropriate chemicals. And in fact, you can barely show it, but that one says DA. It's a modified version of A, admin. A, C, G, T. Is actually visible if you blow up the picture. So Agilent allowed it, and it's done in a clean room. It's a difficult thing to do. Humans aren't great at making DNA. We're very good at copying DNA, but making the first copy is hard. So that's Agilent, and just to keep us vaguely up to date, there's other companies. This is pictures from a company called Twist Bioscience, which was set up by someone who left Agilent. There is a legal dispute about whether she was legally entitled to take with her the knowledge and staff that went with her to Twist Bioscience. And they're essentially doing very much the same thing in a miniaturized form. They've got some clever patterning of the way they locate the spots of DNA. They're using a silicon wafer because they want to etch it to have different shapes. You can't see it from above, but they're printing their DNA into regions which has a contoured pattern in this sort of hexagon shape, and then there's some clever chemistry they can do afterwards. And it's tiny, 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 tiny. So this is a standard corner of a 96 well plate, so that's something, the whole thing's like that, so you're looking at something like that. That's their silicon wafer, and you can zoom in on some of those dots and they're like this, and inside each one of those is this, and they can address multiple spots inside each circle there. So it's very, very accurate printing. They can make lots and lots of so DNA writing, we're not great at humans. We humans are not great at it, but it can be done. Reading is relatively easy. So this is, we did some experiments in 2012. When we started working on this project, this is what a genome reading machine looked like.
I just asked the question about the previous slide. How much information is stored in this way? Right.
121 spots.
29,000 reported on that chip.
That chip, okay. So that's on that, that's 30,000, approximately 30,000 spots that they can address separately. On each spot, they make one design piece of DNA. They can make it about 200 letters, A's, G's, and T's long. Maybe, yeah.
Multiple copies.
Yeah, and they make multiple copies of that, but they can't control that those copies are essentially identical. So 29,000 spots times 200 nucleotides, and then each nucleotide raw without what is two bits. So a choice of four.
And that's 3-4 years ago. I think they
yeah. So
half an order of magnitude.
So I know the standard. One of the they've got one, now. One of the ones they do is 750,000. But I think it's a bigger.
It's about 10 megabytes, if I
They do more slightly denser now, but it's not more than it's not an order of magnitude better.
How much does it cost right now to write 10?
We'll get back to that, but a lot. So this is the reader, this is the old reader, and so you prepare a DNA sample, you do the right chemistry, you place it inside it, somewhere inside this machine. There's a computer under the desk that's controlling the machine. You wait a number of hours or even days, and it will read the fragments of DNA you put into it. Actually, it reads very, very many fragments, more or less simultaneously. But each letter of each fragment takes a little while. So in the end, it takes days to run this machine. So that's an Illumina machine. The current Illumina machines, one that's better than that, would now be this kind of size and have the computers built in. So they've got bigger and smaller, smaller and faster. This is, actually it's not now, that's a prototype version of the next generation of machines. That's from a company from Oxford, spun out from Oxford University. And that machine can do, it's not quite as powerful as this, but it's much, much smaller, clearly. It's portable. They've done studies using it all over the world. They've taken them into space. And that just plugs into a USB port on a laptop, and that's all the computing power you need. And so that's the next. We're kind of just waiting for the successors of these machines to become obsolete and will be taken over by these guys. Next, so and these both the reading technology comes out of genomics research. People want to read genomes and understand what's in there, so it comes from biomedical research. The writing technology was inspired by the same thing because it's very valuable in all sorts of experiments to be able to introduce fragments of DNA where you have designed them, you know what is in there, whereas a typical experiment on biological material, you're trying to understand something about DNA that you don't know so much about, but you can design all sorts of great experiments using DNA that you have designed. And then you need a language, and this is not the language you use, this is the reasonably well-known genetic code or the code of life, which is the way nature has devised, evolved, in order to store some of the information that's stored in the genomes of living organisms. So this is a famous, it's a three-letter code, every triplet of ACGT is eventually in a cell translated to form an amino acid, which is the elements that proteins are made out of. And in a sense, the DNA double helix is kind of pulled apart so that other chemicals, enzymes can access it, and they, as it were, read the letters in groups of three. And depending on what the group of three is, for example, this version of the table, the first of each triplet is the inner circle. So you can pick A, C, G, or T and find it in the inner circle. And once you've done that, if the next letter is A, C, G, or T second, that's what the second circle outwards from the centre is. And the third one, and by the time you've read out to the outside, these are the one letter codes for the 20 different amino acids, which is what all proteins are made out of. So this is what we humans worked out in the 1960s. As to how the information, it's not all the information in genomics, but a major part that we understand a lot about is the way proteins are made by reading the DNA in the genome and using that as a kind of menu for how you put together all the different proteins, 25,000 different proteins that go into a living human cell. And this is the same code, but in a different way. But this is no use to us if what we want to store is digital information. So, like that you might store on your phone or on a computer. It's only good for storing. This code uses A's, C's, G's and T's, which is good, but it will only encode proteins, which is not good. And so our almost arguably only contribution to this project was to invent a code. I'll skip past it, we might come back to some of that. And we needed a code that would hold the information but also would have to deal with some of the peculiarities of DNA, which is different from other storage media. And one of them is when you get a when your phone gets a message from another phone, all the bits of the message arrive in the right order. And you can rely on that. You don't send a bit from the end of the conversation at the beginning of the message. And if there is a little problem along the way, Yossi's phone and my phone have really accurate clocks in them that tick at the same speed. So if something goes wrong in between there and here and I lose 100 bits of the message, I know there's 100 bits that I've maybe misread, but we remain synchronised. So when the signal clears up again, when the cloud goes out of the way or the bus moves on or whatever it is, we're still synchronised, and so it's easy to pick up and carry on from there. Now, those are something that doesn't happen with DNA. When you read DNA, you lose control of the order of the pieces. They're just in a soup. They're a bunch of chemicals floating around in a liquid in a test tube. You can't control which one you read first or second or last, or you need an entirely different system to do that. And when you do get errors, you'll get some where you misread it or the wrong piece of DNA has been inserted when it was being made. But often what happens is you get some extra ones or some are missing, but we don't have a synchronized clock to tell us that. So I liken it to a big box of Lego. Each message is a sequence of A, C, G, and T, or blue, red, yellow, or green chemicals, or here, pieces of Lego, and they arrive in blocks that should all have a certain length and should mean something, but there will be some errors, and some of them will be broken. And some of them will have the wrong colour piece in the wrong place, and some of them will have bits missing, and some will have extra bits in. And out of that soup out of that box of broken up bits of Lego, you have to work out which bits are the message and which are not the message, and how you put them together, which one should be first, second, and third, and fourth. We knew that's how it's going to come. We had to invent a code that would mean once we got this jumble of Lego back, we could put back together the original message we started with. And in a schematic version, that's what we did, which was mine and you and Bernie's contribution to the project. And so it doesn't show all the detail. Again, I won't rely on it, but if we have time, I can explain a bit more. But we assumed that we would start with something that's in binary. So we're going to start with something that's already on some kind of computer and is stored in binary. And mostly, a lot of these systems might think about it being stored in bytes, but we read bytes typically, but we treated them as zeros and ones. Okay, we start with zeros and ones. We want to finish up with fragments of DNA, or at least the designs of fragments of DNA that hold that message, so that even though there will be some errors along the way, and all the pieces will come back possibly damaged, or some of them damaged, and in a randomized order, we can still put the message back together. And we had, this illustrates some of the elements of that code, but we did some extra things to make it work better. So one of them, we set ourselves the rule that we would never have the same letter, ACGT, the same molecule, twice in a row in our encoded message. And that's because we knew that having repeats is a bit more difficult for writing and in the reading process. And in fact, never even allowing two in a row was kind of overkill. That two in a row isn't a problem. So when you get to six or seven, it might become problematic. But we thought, just to prove a point, we will never have any repeats. And we also have to deal with the fact that there would be errors, so we did all sorts of duplications, so that even if some fragments got lost or were severely damaged, there'd be others that held the same information. And we had to deal with the fact that we can't create, humans are unable to create, very long pieces of DNA, certainly not long enough to encode an entire file from a computer. So we had to work within our limits of something in the region of 200 letters of DNA long in each fragment. But that means we're going to have a big sort of jigsaw puzzle and have to put them back together in the end. So we have to have an indexing system so that we read each one. It kind of told us which file it belonged to and where in that file it belonged. And so we ended up with a code that we felt would do that. And this is our graphics person. This is our whole experiment in one easy to understand slide. It starts with my laptop computer taking binary piece of file of information or multiple files. I convert that to the designs for fragments of DNA. I send those, I upload those. A company in California, originally did this with Agilent, who actually make the DNA. So this is actually the inkjet printer kind of machine. They made the DNA. Now we don't have a device that does the whole thing in one place, so they then FedEx that back to us in Cambridge, and they said, here's your DNA. Do what you like with it. And my colleague Paul Pattoni, who is competent in a lab, unlike me, did a bit of the preparation of the DNA sample in Cambridge, but then we sent it off to our Heidelberg offices, where they have the laboratory facilities and they have sequencing machines that I showed you before, and they read the DNA sequence there, and then that was sent back to me. In fact, my postdoc brought it on a hard disk drive and said, here's the information, because the file transfer wasn't so reliable in those days for that much data. We could have done it, but he happened to be coming with us. So he sent him with a hard disk, and it came back to me, and I decoded it, and we looked to see if we had successfully stored and recovered the information. So what we picked to store would be things that we thought would be good PR, basically. So the photo of our own institute, obviously, would be stored. We thought if this all worked, we might be able to get this published in Nature. Maybe if we were lucky. So we contacted them in advance and said, oh, could we're doing this project about storing information, could we put a copy of Watson and Crick's paper that first described the structure of DNA, could we encode that please for our experiment? Because we thought if they agree to that, then when we send them the paper, they can't really say no, we aren't published. So that was totally cynical of us to do that one. And then we kind of wanted things of enormous historical significance. And what we chose was Shakespeare, and we would have liked to do all of Shakespeare, but the file sizes were too big. We only had a limited budget of how much DNA we could use. So in fact, what we picked was all of Shakespeare's sonnets, which are freely available and copyrighted on the internet, fortunately. And an extract from Martin Luther King, the recording of him delivering his I Have a Dream speech, which is arguably out of copyright or not, depending on whether you're a member of his family or not, which I didn't realise at the time. We've not had any trouble about that, but occasionally people say, you do know that they don't let you reproduce that, at which point I say, I think this is fair use under the copyright law. I have no idea if it's fair use under the copyright law. Things that are historically significant, and we want it, I mean, it's all binary, right? It's all zeros and ones. We don't mess with the internal format of the JPEG or the PDF or the MP3 file, but we thought, if people don't understand what we're doing, we'll use different file formats, and then people, oh, they can do PDFs and MP3s, but of course we can, it's just zeros and ones. So that's what we picked, and they sent us back in this picture, this box, it's about that big, with five, we ended up with five tubes of DNA, and in fact, any one of them had plenty. It's an invisibly small amount of DNA. In fact, my reaction when I got it was I thought they'd not sent us anything. And I went to my colleague, Paul Bertone, down the corridor, and I went, Paul, there's no DNA. And he taught me how you spot it, which is you hold it up to the light, and if it looks like there's a tiny smudge of dirt, or what it looks like is if you've got salt water and the water evaporates off, and you get a little residue film on the side of a glass or something, it looks like that, a tiny speck of it in the bottom of a test tube. One plastic record or one. And so our almost 1 megabyte of computer turned into a essentially invisible dust of DNA. And that went, this is my colleague Paul Bertone, who used to work at EBI with me and who is competent in the laboratory. And this is him and the day they let me into the lab in Heidelberg. And that was the sequencing machine that my DNA was read on. And then it gets hard to say it worked because there's no good graphics for that. So the graphic is, this is the picture we started with, and that's the same picture again after we decoded it. So there you go. So I've got a green tick on. And they all worked. And the only good story is that I was phoned up by a Swiss journalist who said, could I send a picture of the decoded version of the picture, please? Because she wanted to check. And I said, but it's the same as the other one. It doesn't just look the same, it is the same. I checked every zero and every one. They are identical. And she wouldn't accept that that meant we'd done it successfully. And I had to email her a file. So, but, I mean, what is the original file, right? It's just, you know, I had hundreds of copies of it on my disk by this time. I don't know which was, you know, the original. So I just emailed her randomly one of the copies of the, because they're all the same, because I knew they were the same. And is it the same when I email it to her? I mean, she doesn't get the copyright. She just gets some electrons arrive at her computer, which her computer interprets as a JPEG. But she phoned me up the next day to reassure me that it was the same. So that was a big relief. So it all worked. And then that was a number of years ago. And other things have happened since then. We got lots of publicity after some stories of refreshments before, it's excellent. It's the only piece of research I've ever done that got any coverage. A number of companies are interested. People that understand the value of storing digital information or information for a long time include film companies who have lost information that they now realise potentially have been valuable, and companies responsible for making digital media are interested. We've spoken to people from all of these companies. I guess we can admit we talk to them, but we don't deal with them anymore because they're all spies, apparently. And we had a fantastic day. We tried to set up a company to commercialise science aspects of doing this, and at one point we were asked by potential investors if we could propose some other people that would give their opinion on whether it was a good idea to invest in it. And I thought it was odd they were asking us to do that, because obviously we were just our own friends. But at the time we'd heard that IBM were doing it. We had a contact in IBM who taught us. And I had on the same day, I had the experience that I phoned up one person at IBM and said, would they be prepared to talk to the people that were thinking of investing in us and give them IBM's opinion on DNA as a digital storage medium? And the guy said, yeah, that's fine, you can give them my name and my email address. And I spoke to someone else at IBM in Texas on the same day, who on that same day denied that IBM had any team looking at DNA as a digital storage medium. And there's been no sign since, so they either are or aren't doing it. So, and some of these will get mentioned again when I've got some more sort of updates of what's going on, but there's commercial interest. I've been involved in some very strange projects, including with a fantastic British artist called Charlotte Jarvis, who loves working with scientists and spends her time finding out about cool scientific ideas and trying to turn them into art. And she liked this idea. In fact, she was already thinking of something quite similar when we first met. And she commissioned a piece by a rather avant-garde, in my opinion, set of musicians, what they called I'll come back to me. And they wrote a piece of music which they then recorded in studio. It's in three short movements. And they recorded the second movement, and then we encoded that MP3 in DNA, and then they then destroyed the sheet music and the recording. So the second movement exists only in a DNA form. And then at a performance, so Charlotte has taken the DNA and she mixes it up with Kiddie's bubble mix. And she loves the idea that the music will all be in the air because it's in the DNA, which is in the bubbles, which are blown in the air. So they do a performance. This is them, for publicity purposes, playing in our data centre. Because it looks cool to have violinists playing in a data centre. But a performance is that they sit there, the musicians sit, and they play the first movement, which is 3 or 4 minutes long. And then they fall silent. This is one that was done in a church in South London. And then they sit there silently while the bubbles blow in the air. The second movement in the air, and it lands on you, and you walk home with it. And then, after exactly whatever 2 minutes and 25 seconds, they play the third movement.
Is it any good, the second movement?
I didn't enjoy any of the music very much, but that's a personal thing. They are professional musicians. They have a recording contacts and everything. So the failing is mine, not theirs. This was a fun project. I was invited to the World Economic Forum in Davos in 2015. And I thought, oh, you've got lots of bankers and things there, and it's all about money. So the only way to catch their attention. Yeah, it was very impressive. I really enjoyed spending 3 or 4 days there. They, as well as all the boring economic stuff, they have a kind of sideline in cool sciencey projects, and they invite scientists in. I was really impressed with the quality of the other presentations I saw from scientists who are really trying to make science accessible to well-educated people who are not scientists. And it was really a fantastic experience to have been there and seen it. And I thought I might capture their attention by talking about Bitcoin. Everything's digital nowadays, even money is digital. And so we bought the Bitcoin in late 2014. It cost about $200. And we did what you're not meant to do, which is we publicised the private key part, so the supposedly secret part of the Bitcoin. But we publicised it only by encoding it in DNA, and at the end of my presentation, like 20 minutes in Davos, I gave out samples and said, there's Bitcoin encoded in this DNA. See, if you can read it, you can get the first person that reads it and goes online can get the Bitcoin, and they will do that. The sideline, way too long. Small note, I never noticed this. This is a still taken, the presentation is on YouTube. And in the comments, and there's a lot of very funny comments below the line, so to speak, on the YouTube thing, and there's the usual, oh, how could it be any, this proves the existence of God, because how could anything as powerful as DNA exist if it wasn't for God? That was a good one. But one of them says, is that Bill Gates, bottom right, at 7 minutes 43 seconds? What do you reckon?
Is it?
I don't know, I didn't notice. So when I was there panicking about giving a talk at the World Economic Forum, I did not notice Bill Gates. But you know, might well be, I think. I'm going to imagine it is. So we did this, and we gave out these DNA samples, a little test tube we did like a print up a business card kind of thing, saying to do that. And no one did claim the Bitcoin, and it was going on. And then the value of Bitcoin went like that, and so we bought it at $200, and it went up to 15,000. And at that point, I thought, this was bought with governmental funding for the sciences, and we didn't really have a very good audit track on this $200 that had become 15,000 that we were giving away in DNA format. So I discussed it with people at work, and we said we should kind of draw a line on the competition and take the money back if it hadn't gone by a certain date. So we picked a date that would be 3 years from when I gave this out, the initial samples, and we publicised this on Twitter and so on. And a few people got in touch and said, oh, we've still got samples, we'll have a go, there's still a month, 2 months to go. And there was one guy, Jan Verlich, who asked for a sample. I thought, he's good, and this is the guy who really knows, and he's got access to a laboratory, and he's a very good computer scientist. So I thought, if anyone was going to get it, it would be him, and he clearly had the skills to do it. And so I worried about that, and I kind of ignored the other four or five people. And we got down to the last week till the money was mine, my employers. And I was working at home, and I got an email from a PhD student in Antwerp that said, I've got your Bitcoin, I've decoded it. And so my initial reaction was, damn. And my second reaction was to check whether this was true or not, and there's, you know, websites you can go and I see where your Bitcoin is, and it was gone. And so he clearly had got the Bitcoin. And so my third reaction was, okay, so the best thing now is to turn this into some good PR. And so this is Sander Voits, who at that time was a PhD student in the University of Antwerp, who got $15,000 worth of Bitcoin from me by decoding it. He was all above board. He asked his PhD supervisor if he could use her lab's facilities to pursue this project. He was a laboratory scientist interested in the computational side, and he thought he would teach himself a bit about DNA and programming by doing this project. And he did it actually with a friend called Stein Bittock, who interestingly I knew because he'd been on a course I teach on about a year before. So Sander, don't you know, the 2 days after I first spoke to him, he said, I had some help from this guy called Stein Bittock. Actually, he knows you. And I said, yeah, I know him. And he got the money, and he got some really good PR, and we got a bit of good PR from doing that one. So that was fun.
He has a blog, by the way. He has a blog.
Yes, and he has it. And I went later that year. I went over to Antwerp and I met him, and they asked me in his department to give a whole other story about James Joyce. But I won't tell that. But they asked me in his department to give a presentation. It's quite good. So I put in the presentation about the Bitcoin and how this student called Sander Voits. But obviously he's in the audience, it's his department. So I gave him 24 hours notice and I said, you give this bit of the talk. So we did this fun double act thing where I gave 2/3 of a talk and then he came and delivered the next 10 minutes worth and told the story from his point of view. And then I finished. Oh, and yeah, as Justin says, he's written he's got a blog about how he did it, which is quite fun.
It's really fun.
His PhD was on carrot fermentation. And he's now actually, he got his PhD, and he now has a postdoc position in our organisation, but in Heidelberg, in the laboratory there. He's working with Pierre scientists in Heidelberg. So I haven't seen him since he moved to our organisation, but this time over there, obviously go and say hello again. He's a really nice guy. And then this is the hot breaking news. Alan knows about this one, you obviously may have heard of it, I can't remember. So you get asked to do these cool projects. So UNICEF got in touch earlier this year. And last Wednesday was the 30th anniversary of the adoption by the UN of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is kind of the document that defines UNICEF and their work. And they wanted to store a copy of the Convention on the Rights of the Child in a DNA format as a publicity, but to make the point that you could store it and it would last for a long time, something like that. And they were going to store that in Svalbard, and if you don't know what Svalbard is, here's the UK, here's Norway, Sweden, Finland, Orient, there's Greenland, and there's Svalbard, so you're halfway from the Arctic Circle to the North Pole, so it's 78 degrees north. And the Global Seed Vault is there, which is an international collaboration where seeds are stored in a permafrost mountain, where they will be safe for all time. And there's also something called the Arctic World Archive, which is a smaller setup, which is aiming to store digital information securely. And UNICEF wanted to have the Convention on the Rights of the Child in a DNA format, in a kind of presentation box, which would be placed in the Arctic World Archive. So last week I was at 78 degrees north. I just love when I can share my holiday photos. It was work. So that's Svalbard. This metal box is the Arctic World Archive, and that's me. And it's in a disused coal mine in the mountainside, into the mountain in Svalbard. So it's permanently at -2.5 degrees. So it's not really, really cold, but it's cold. And this is me and the guy who runs the Optic World Archive, and she's something important in UNICEF, and she's the comms officer for UNICEF, and he's important, and she's not a comms person, and she's their intern, and she was brilliant. She's an intern, and they let her do logistics of this whole thing of getting us all there. About I told her to come to UBI for a job, and she's got an economics degree, and she's about to go and do a master's, and I just said she'd come and work for us, and she's done. She was fantastic. That's Tuba. She was the best, all of them, I thought. And that's Tuba with the box, and there's a tiny little thing, but the white speck is a little capsule with DNA sealed inside it that we deposited in there. That's the closest I got to a polar bear. That's one in the museum that they shot in 2005, because it got too close to people and wouldn't turn away. And this is the kind of photo you get if you're with professional photographers. So there's no light. They're in 24 hours of darkness since a couple of weeks ago. And you take pictures with your camera, with your phone, and it's basically just coming out of black. And if you're with someone with a seriously good low-light camera, you just get pictures like this. And this is the sign they have when you're leaving the area that's safe from polar bears, and entering the area where you have to have someone carrying a rifle with you, and the sign says that throughout all the Svalbard. So the default situation is there may be polar bears, but there are certain regions where you're largely safe. So that was my holiday last week, was to be there depositing this for UNICEF. So these are all kind of just fun projects, which are good for PR. There is some more serious research going on. So here's two teams or collaborations that were also interested right from the start. So a team at Harvard University worked with Technicolor, and they encoded, what's the film called, Voyage dans la Lune, so Voyage to the Moon from 1902, which if you're a science fiction film buff, no, it's the first science fiction movie ever made. The Technicolor were interested in storing in a video into DNA to see if that was possible. And I don't know if that collaboration is still going, but there's a lot of work going on in the University of Washington in Seattle, working with Microsoft in Seattle. And they've encoded all sorts of things. So they've got YouTube videos of pop groups and photographs. And obviously they won because they were the first people to think of storing a picture of cat. What the internet is for. So there's other fun projects sort of proving it's possible, working on improving the methods we would do with this. The University of Washington Microsoft team have now made the first machine that can do the whole process end to end in one machine. So it's a bit Heath Robinson, but it sits on desks about this big. And up at this end, they're making DNA. They've got the raw chemicals, and they've got a process that synthesizes DNA. Up at one end.
I thought it was only the beaker.
No, it's the whole thing. So up this end, they're making DNA on a little chip thing over there, and then they've got automated fluidics that can move the DNA off and sort of store it, so they dry it out. It's on a glass plate or maybe a silicon wafer, I'm not quite sure what they're using. And then they can move it over here to add liquid again, put it into solution, and there's a... There. That is one of those little handheld size readers, these new ones, sitting at the end. So they can do the whole thing, I mean what they really want to do, and they're talking about having a saleable product in the next 2 or 3 years. I mean, that's quite optimistic, so now we're approaching feasible, I'm not sure that's really feasible. But that's what they're aiming for, and obviously they want to shrink that down to something smaller and more robust and faster and less expensive. And this is very nice, this is from Robert Grass, you must recognize this one. He's working in Zurich, and he's a applied chemist, I guess is the word, and he's got a process that allows him to seal DNA inside tiny glass beads. And so in fact it starts with a glass bead, and then DNA, it's quite easy to get DNA to sort of stick on the surface, and then he can grow a layer of glass outside that as well. And there's a bit of damage to the DNA, but a lot of it is still intact, and then it's much more stable because it's protected from moisture in particular is important. And this wonderful picture that his, I think, student, William Koch, created, which in each one of these little white dots is one of these beads. The amount of DNA that's safely stored in the bead, or on the bead, it holds something like 17,000 bits of information. That's, and what the background of the slide is the surface of a DVD under a microscope, and each little bar like that is how one bit is stored on a DVD circuit. So that's one bit on a DVD. That little white dot is 17,000 bits inside a glass bead. So it's really, really, really small. And there's more things going on. So people are now interested in what do we need to do to make an actual useful information storage system. So the bottleneck, the hardest thing, is the synthesis of DNA. We humans are not good at doing that. We can't make long pieces of DNA. It's too slow. It's very expensive. There's companies trying to improve the existing sort of chemical processes, which is phosphoramidite synthesis, is what they call it. It's using modified version of DNA molecules. They're trying to make that more precise, faster, less expensive. There's other ideas for how you'd create DNA to demand, and there's a number of startups. We have a meeting we do about every year or so, and each time we do that, there's more startups that want to come along. And then they don't say anything because they're not prepared to tell you what they're doing because they're a startup company, and they're worried about the competition. It's incredibly frustrating. And the only good thing is they will often sponsor the meeting, so it doesn't cost us anything to have them there. In fact, it's financially beneficial, but it's not very informative. New ways of encoding. So I showed you a little bit about the code we use. That can definitely be improved. Yossi's worked on that. Other people are working on that. Get more information into the same amount of DNA with less chance of error. The way we did it was, well, it was undergraduate maths level, let's say, for that. Could easily be improved. Random access memory would be nice. At the moment, you take your whole DNA sample to read it back. You can't pick out just the bits you want, but people have got ideas on how you would extract just the elements you want, but not the ones you don't want to read today. The first tabletop device, I showed you that. Without spending more time on it, Microsoft or the University of Washington, part of that team in particular, very interested in whether you can not only store the information in DNA, but then do some kind of computing on the DNA form, not by reading it back onto a computer. And they've actually got a kind of a version of an image search, which operates at the level of DNA. They can compare images in DNA. And then Robert Brass in Zurich, because he can make the DNA much more secure in the glass beads, he can then put those glass beads into other manufacturing processes. And he has failed so far, but is very keen to strike up a deal with the Swiss Army knife people, where the plastic element of the knife could include little glass beads that you wouldn't notice, but they'd have DNA inside. If there was ever an argument about forged knives, fake knives, you know, they would be the only ones that had the right DNA signal in there. So that's the kind of idea he has, and this is just some fun he's having with 3D printing of rabbits, which have got DNA. So he thinks it's like a real animal because it's a rabbit and it's got DNA inside it. I realise it's been too long. Why are we even interested in this? First of all, are we not interested? It comes back to the question you had before. You got to the point, which is that it's stupidly expensive to do this. So all the processes, the writing and the reading, can all be done in parallel. So if you want to make it faster, you could just invest in more machines to do it. But the cost of those machines, the cost of running the processes of the chemicals, is insanely high. So we computed 5 or 6 years ago, I think $28,000 per megabyte is essentially the cost. So there's not much of a market for that. I think probably it's really hard to tell what the price is now. Some of the companies, the new companies, are quite aggressive about what it will be, but they're not really offering.
It's at least let's say it's one gensphere.
Yeah. So they say that. I've never seen like the price list from them in particular, actually. And we've done further work with them, and mostly we paid for, what did we pay for, 30,000? I can't remember.
But it wasn't that, it was experimental.
Yeah, it was experimental. And other things we persuaded, like for UNICEF, that was working with Twist, and they did that for free. Twist did that for free, so I don't know what they actually charge. But it's too much and it's too slow. So really, this is never going to work until the price comes down by about 5 orders of magnitude, is our back of envelope estimate. Having said that, genome reading came down by 6 orders of magnitude between the year 2000 and the year 2008 or something. So in genomics, we are used to things going at multiple orders of magnitude every few years. It just hasn't happened yet with writing But back to, there are some good features. So one is it's incredibly small, so you don't need much space to do it. So I showed the original test tube we had is pretty much the size of two joints of your little finger. And that had, I said it was an invisible quantity of DNA. If that was full of DNA, that would be a couple of petabytes of information or something like a million CD-ROMs. And what I used, it was a good example a few years ago, and I used to say, oh, that'd be like having the whole front area where I'm standing this deep in CDs, or one little thing. And, but no one knows what CD is anymore. So now we tend to say that if you fill the test tube to the brim with DNA, it will be like 30,000 items. I don't know how big 30,000 items is.
Pretty big.
It's pretty big. Exactly. And the reviewers at Nature wanted us to, would it really scale to global scale? Like, it doesn't matter because no one can afford it. But we did a graph to prove to them that got published, saying yes, this system would scale up. You know, if you had the money, you could store more and more information. And the alternative version is to say, the whole internet fits in the back of a van. Yeah.
The entire internet.
Yeah, all of it in one truck. You've not got an indexing system. Unfortunately, you need lots and lots of boxes or read the whole thing, but the actual storage medium would be, back when we did the calculation, it's not even the whole truck, it's 1 meter cubed, with the whole measurement.
Can I just point out that, is that depending on how you use that for the envelope calculation, in Nature there's recently a thing that argued it is 1 kilogram. And I've argued that.
Yes.
I from my background.
That you could do that. It's not
every. Yeah. It depends on what assumption you make.
That's right. We were quite conservative with our calculation. And it was based on our original experiment where we were very, very cautious with the amounts of DNA and the way we did the encoding. I agree. It could be a lot less than one.
But that's only volume. It could be that whole thing is 1 kilogram.
No, I was assuming it's about the same density as water. As a powder, as it were, the density of DNA is about 1. So it's really small. So it lasts a really, really long time. So most people that talk about accelerated aging experiments and so on. But I'm an evolution scientist, right? I've done the experiment about DNA lasting a long time. We have DNA samples from mammoths that are from 20,000 years ago, and from Neanderthals 40,000, bison from 60,000 years ago. The kind of world record is ancient horses, where they've read large parts of ancient horse genome DNA from 750,000 years ago. And these aren't carefully prepared experiments, you know, in the permafrost in Svalbard. These are just things that died somewhere cold. But that's pretty good conditions for keeping DNA. You need it to be cold is helpful, dry is very important, and in the dark is helpful as well. And anywhere that's below freezing is essentially dry, because with any moisture it freezes, which is why if you leave things in your freezer too long at home, they end up drying out. I don't know if you have that experience with frozen bread, but it gets very dry. And so we know that DNA will last hundreds of thousands, and in fact in all of these cases there is some damage, but in all of these cases it's been possible because there's a lot of DNA available in many of these, that you can read the DNA, understand what the errors are, what the breaks and the missing bits are, and piece together the jigsaw. So it lasts a very, very long time, which is good for storing information. And my slide used to be, so you could put it in the global seed vault in Svalbard, where they store the seeds. Of course, I now want to update this and say, you can put it in the Arctic World Archive, where I've been, and store it for a long time. So this is just a mile away from the Arctic World Archive, where my holiday photos were taken. I contacted them and said, I'm going to be in Svalbard, is there any chance I could look around? And they said, no, we don't let people come and see it. It's only open twice a year, we don't let people in. He has really, it doesn't show very well in this picture, they've got green lights at the top, the bit that's kind of frosted up at the top of the building, and it looks a bit like the Northern Lights. It's very beautiful. Drove past it a number of times, but you couldn't go up the road to see it. And if you don't have a seed vault or Svalbard available, you have probably got one of those, and that's a very good way of storing DNA a long time if you want to. So you don't need fancy equipment to store it. You know, somewhere cold, dark is fine. DNA is brilliant for making copies, and this is the thing that nature discovered or invented with the double helix. The idea of that is that once you've got those two copies, what happens in nature, and humans are able in the laboratory to mimic this, there's machines that look like this, that do it, it's absolutely routine, please. Every lab has one of these, a few hundred dollars maximum. And what happens is you essentially heat the DNA up enough so that the two parts of the helix separate from each other, and then you put in lots of raw DNA chemicals and appropriate enzymes, and the enzymes move along the different strands and create a copy of the missing opposite strand. So you start with one helix, one pair, you end up, you have two separate ones, you make the other strand for each of those, and now you have two, and then you repeat that, and that two, I've run out of fingers, becomes four, and then eight, and then 16, and it doesn't take very long, as everyone knows from various jokes and stories, until you have millions and millions of copies. So if you want a storage system that says, we'll spend a lot of money once making the DNA, and then we'll very readily make thousands or millions of copies and distribute those everywhere, then that's a very safe way of keeping it, which is much easier than the processes we have for copying documents, which is a linear process. If you want a million copies, you spend a lot of time to photocopy it. Or hard disk drives, where you need machines vaguely like that, which assemble hard disks. If you want to copy DNA information, you just have one of these machines, and the process for making the other copy acts directly on the medium itself. Here, if you want to make a copy onto a million hard disk drives, you have to assemble a million hard disk drives, and then each one has to be put onto a computer and have information in front of it. And the last point is that these are all, you always have to gauge the age of your audience at this point, these are all ways of storing information digitally that you may or may not have used at some point in your life, depending how old you are. I have used all of those except not card. I never used card, but I did, so I think that's right, because that would have been first, right? And I used paper tape when I was a teenager. Anyway, they've all held digital information. If you've got any of those lying around at home in your garage, it's almost certainly decayed to the point of being useless. But if somehow miraculously it hasn't, you haven't got a reader for it anymore either. And these are largely a bunch of things that we use today. How long are those going to last? And in 50 years, will you have a reader for them? Probably not. And if we use DNA, we will have a reader in 50 years, as long as we've got humans still and technology, because we aren't going to throw away a DNA reader because we're going to need it for biomedical reasons, for personalized healthcare, for understanding biodiversity in the world. We will surely change the actual machine. At the moment, about every 2 years, there's a new technology that comes along that does the reading, but the aim is always the same: tell me what the sequence of letters in this fragment of DNA is, please. So put it away in Svalbard, wait 1,000 years, come back to it, take your current DNA reader, and you can get the image. So I think that's, is it feasible? That was meant to be my title, so my quick summary is, maybe if it gets a lot cheaper, there'll become a market for your ultimate backup copy being in DNA. It won't get cheap enough or fast enough to replace this thing that I brought my talk in with me today, or the hard disk drive in here. I don't imagine they'll ever be filled with DNA. But if it gets down, you know, if all my holiday photos for the year could be put somewhere safe for $50, so that if all my computer systems break, I can go and get them back from there, then you've maybe got a market. So maybe 10 years? I think it's really interesting that it's spawned a lot of research into things that will have value. New coding techniques, the ability to synthesize DNA, to read DNA, they're all going to have value. It's quite a fun project to think about putting them all together, but even if it doesn't work out, we'll have learned lots of useful things along the way. And lastly, I'm very sorry, I've gone much too long, but I have to thank, I always love those talks. I never had a project for years where you had lots of people to thank. I was always in awe of the people that managed to juggle the competing desires of 30 different researchers. I think, Jossi can remind, I think it's a largely complete... missing. Tom, you're right. So we've got one more that we should add. Absolutely. So it was me and Ewan Burney, who is now director of EBI, where I work, who dreamt this up. Paul Bertoni advised us on the chemistry and how you do sequencing. And Christoph Detmer and Vartan Sipos, who used to work with me, helped out enormously when we had to revise the paper to get into Nature. So we were panic, and they did that. Emily LaPruist, who formerly worked at Agilent and then moved to Twist Bioscience, and Siwan Chen, who did exactly the same, did the DNA synthesis, advised us on DNA synthesis and done that, and in order, various people around Cambridge and in Heidelberg helped us out. Not much more to add there. Emily worked in the laboratory for us at the Sanger Institute, the office in the room, who worked on the coding aspect, who is working on the coding aspect. And I will shut up. Thank you very much for staying and listening. And I will.
There's two at the bottom. You've got Art Wheat. I don't know if you mentioned Charlotte.
So it's Charlotte's the artist with the bubbles.
With the bubbles
in the air, and right. Professionally, if you're interested, I mean, go Google her at some point. But you can find her by name or her kind of professional working company name is Art for Eating. Echidna is the failed venture to set up a company. We never managed to get the funding for that. There were aspects where we wanted to do more research which fit the academic model of getting a grant and working it out, and there were things we wanted to do that we felt would only work in a commercial setting with investment money and different ways of raising money and different expectations about what you do with outputs and so on. And we attempted, with myself and Ewan and someone from Oliver Bradley, to set up a company which was nominally called Echidna, and that didn't work out, and we more or less dropped that.
But it's nice you've got him on there, though. Yeah. Gosh, I mean, that is a cool talk, isn't it? Literally.
Yes. Can you explain something to me? I'm thinking linearly. I mean, if taking your extreme example of the internet sitting in the booth, and yet you're talking about effectively powder or dust, I mean, my limited understanding that you need lots of little bits of dust to reflect the files. But you seem to be saying you can jumble it all together and somehow you can still, without the scaling up, you can get out the little bits you want.
No, so the getting out the bits you want is difficult, so I'm cheating a bit by saying it all goes in the van, because that doesn't allow appropriate indexing. That would, having it all in a van is like taking all the books in the world and ripping all the pages out, so each page is separate, and sticking those somewhere. We could do it in such a way that when we got all the pages out, we would know which one which it went in which book and where it belonged. So it's like each page would have the page number and the title of the book on it. But I'm ignoring the problem of how would you get just the pages of just the book you want. And to do that, you need some combination of physically separating or indexing the pieces so that they're not all jumbled, so that you, just as a library does, a library organises the pages in bound books and it arranges the books on the shelf and it has a catalogue, and so there is a system for finding the one you want. So I ignored the bulk or a system for doing that. So partly you could do that by the physical separation, and the other thing would be to what extent things people are working on. Could you, for example, do a sequencing reaction where you, as it were, put the whole thing in a machine, but it managed to just read the bits you needed and kind of left the rest untouched for you. So it's not a fair comparison. The truck comparison is not comparing light with any light that exists for other information. It's just fun to think about the raw information of the couple of space.
The final thing you said seemed to me the absolutely key thing that will always be a reason for this. I mean, surely that is possibly its strongest case, because all media run out of time, as you say, and that is a serious problem for our
industry, isn't it? I think the summarised version is it's a storage system that can work in an unsupervised, unmanaged way for almost indefinitely long. You don't need, at the moment, you know, if you you do your backups at home or whatever on a separate disk drive, you have to remember to do it, and you have to hope that disk isn't damaged, and eventually that disk will be obsolete, and you'll need to remember to get the information, pass it through your computer onto your next generation of whatever storage device it is. So that requires energy, it requires pieces of hardware, it requires you to manage the process and remember to do it. And I think this, a common misapprehension now is that this is all done because we store things on the cloud, whatever that means, Google or Amazon or something. But in fact, you're just outsourcing the management to a company that is somewhere behind the scenes, replacing hardware on a daily basis and managing the transition of information to one from one machine to the next. And you have to rely on being there in a year's time when you want that information back, which, you know, it doesn't look like Google or Amazon will go bust on a 1 year or a 10 year basis, but in 100 years, you know, the world will have changed. With DNA would be a system where you can write it, once you've done that, it's not going to change or degrade appreciably over thousands of years as long as it's kept somewhere pretty safe, but it's not too hard to keep it that safe. And you can ignore it for all that time. It needs no management up to not burn it or something. And then at the end, you can be reasonably confident there will be some sort of reading. There is a fair question about will people in 1,000 years understand how to read it back, but then the same is true of a book or a hard disk drive. You know, will people understand what JPEG format is in 1,000 years? And that relies on us somehow securing that knowledge as well. So I don't think we're offering a different problem to one that exists anyway there, but it is also part of the question of how do you store information or knowledge for hundreds and thousands of years, hundreds or thousands of years.
Can I just ask Nick, just to be clear, writing the DNA language is straightforward, is that correct?
Writing is the hardest part. That's a clean room, or truth by science don't allow you to take photographs of their facility.
We now know how to do that, is that correct?
We know how to do it, but we would like to be able to do it better. We would like to have fewer errors, we would like to do it faster. It's not good enough for a viable system yet. Okay. But we do know how, we have a way of doing it.
And is that going to be developed, you see, experimentally in the future?
Yes, I mean that's ongoing, both in the companies that already do it, improving, and the fact that there are numerous other companies that see the value. There's a market, even if it's only biomedical research, there's a market for manufactured synthetic DNA, and if they can get into data storage, there's potentially a much bigger market for them to go for, and this has inspired, to my knowledge, six or seven startup companies in the US in the last 3 or 4 years who have all raised multi-millions of money. So they must each have an idea that they think is going to make things better.
And reading that...
Reading is easy.
It's straightforward. Shouldn't be a problem for any of those companies.
If you can afford to do the writing, you can surely do the reading. The reading is a long way ahead of. So it would be nice if the reading was also better, and the genome science community is always pushing for better, more accurate, faster, cheaper readers.
Yeah.
But they are so far ahead of our capacity to write at the moment that for our purposes, the only one we need to worry about is the writing.
And the language, that's established, is that correct?
We have a working version. It's really quite naive the way we did it. There's people that have used existing coding methods that work, I should say better than what we did, and there's definitely room for further improvement there, because what they've done, so a lot of the coding theory in the last few years has relied on certain assumptions about synchronization and what form of errors you get, and it's got very good in those circumstances. So, you know, streaming movies or digital phones or even mobile phones work very well, but this problem has a different kind of profile of the errors, and it will be possible to come up with more robust, more efficient codes for these error forms than anyone's done so far.
I mean, still a very accurate
experts here. Yeah.
Is it possible to write a genome? Does your language allow you to write?
So there's been a few examples. So one of the problems there is that what we can, we, I'm saying we humans or Agilent, CRISPR Bioscience, can write maybe 200, maybe 300 bases long. For genome, you need pieces that are multiple millions long. So it has been done in a couple of example studies, but you have to do it by making short pieces and then have a way of joining those together. And in fact, what Twist Bioscience was founded on was not the idea of doing better individual pieces, but they have this contoured silicon wafer that they're putting the DNA on, which enables them to do kind of localized chemistry to join the pieces together. And if you join them all together in exactly the right order, then you get something the size of a genome. So famously, Craig Venter, who got a Nobel Prize for molecular biology technologies, had a project where they created a bacterium and they wrote the genome. They started with the gene, they read the genome of a bacterium, tell a particularly small genome but still many millions of letters long. They modified it a little bit, various interesting ways, but then they wrote that, and then they got a living bacterium, took its DNA out, replaced it with the DNA that they had written, and it lived. And as far as I know, it still lives in a laboratory somewhere in wherever they're California.
So what was that?
That was before us in 2013, so it's somewhere around 2010 or 11 they did that. And there's been a couple of others since, and there's a really interesting project going on now where they are trying to make a synthetic yeast. And we know a lot about many different strains of yeast that have quite different genomes. And there's quite relatively good understanding of what is vital for a yeast and what other combinations are kind of optional. And there's an international collaboration which is putting, it's a much bigger genome bacteria, but they are gradually putting together all the elements for that. And along the way, they make intermediates where, for example, the first ones would be largely the same as an existing yeast, but they replace part of the genome with a synthetic bit, and they can see at each stage if it still lives. And I think, I don't know, next year, I think, something like a year from now, they think they'll have replaced the entire genome with synthetic elements. But they're making all sorts of changes. They're doing astonishing stuff. And in fact, it almost makes no sense that this would still be a living yeast. They've made so many alterations and discovered that you can get away with it. In fact, it's almost a more interesting result of what we've learnt about the plasticity of life, that you can make that many changes and it's still recognisably a living yeast. Which really overturns anything that I understood about what it meant to be yeast, or, you know, what, arguably then will we discover that what it means to be human is not quite what we thought it meant.
I think this expands the GM foods discussion.
Oh, I mean, enormously, yeah. I mean, GM foods just becomes a speck and drop in the ocean compared to understanding what it means to be human or yeast. You had a question about that, I don't know.
Yeah, my understanding is that this discussion was like, just if we had finally lost time, what's the purpose of ultimately for the cap for thousands of years? Will you say market or whatever? Who needs this?
Only people that are worried about making sure knowledge stays around for hundreds or thousands of years. So I think
knowledge is passed from by the people who carry the knowledge. It's not passed by books.
I don't think that's right. I think if we lost all the books and Wikipedia and everything on the internet now, we'd have a lot of trouble.
The books and Wikipedia right now, your DNA is deciphered with your last recording. It's very unlikely.
Right, so it's against some kind of catastrophic disaster.
So it's for Martians.
Global warming, nuclear war.
Nuclear war? Oh, why are you recording about that?
Sure, but are you worrying about... No, it's fine. If you're not worried, that's fine. I don't need to sell it to you.
I know it's nice to comment, so, and I accept that if you do worry about some sort of divine sort of passage of knowledge of humankind in the future or something, then this might be a good question. May I ask some other questions?
Yeah.
When you said about this pickup is all the internet on the back, well, you openly admitted that there was no indexing here, so
yeah.
A question later was dependent that they didn't hear it. I might ask that question. To sequence it right now, because normally you sequence it in the linear trace. You shouldn't have any solvent. Paleo with the solvent in there. How many? It will be impractical.
To dissolve all, I've never done it, but the samples we've done, which obviously are much smaller than the whole
scale, it becomes impractical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that would. So it won't ever be a system that does store it all in one box in the back of a truck. The indexing is
the question of internet with this scale will become quite technically challenging. So it's not only about ephemeral storage, but in fact it's about ephemeral storage of small amount of data.
I don't know how small it would have to be. The examples we did for, no one mentioned it to me as a problem for the examples we've done before, which is in the realm, which is up to megabytes of data.
Megabytes.
So it's not a world. So that's
megabytes is people.
Right. So as long as that's small, that one's okay.
Because practically, when it comes to petabytes, then the challenges are becoming already native. Forget about data.
Okay.
So that's another thing.
That's interesting.
When you say about compactization of information, it's perfect if you think theoretically, but practically, when you compact it to such degree,
so that would
then it's challenging to read what if you could even read.
So that would argue for, if you are wanting to pursue the ideas, doing more in the indexing should be more separation of, so to really minimize the amount of DNA you have to handle for the reading.
My comment was not about indexing, but about the way, because it's definitely compact, definitely long reading, but the very procedures of reading and writing, apart from the costs, are so cumbersome, and I'd like it to be less cumbersome, much less cumbersome, that when it comes to global scale as a whole internet, I don't know, humanity's knowledge, the question about reading.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the reason, not very large amounts of information, but for it. And another thing just technical is you always say about sort of reading it from solution, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Why not to leave it on the solid?
No, you could. Because we've always wanted to do it, we've always wanted to read it back to make sure it did work and so on. So, but we've been through the dry phase. On a number of the experiments, it's delivered to us dry, or we have then dried it again. It could have, but yeah, you could make it on the chip, and then it has physically organized. Yeah, you could leave. Yeah, there's no reason why not. No, absolutely, you could do that.
It will make it less compact. But it will allow to read it much easily.
Yes.
If you keep it in clusters, you just do...
No, that's right. Things. We've never had an example where we didn't want to read it back. But if you knew... Yeah, no, absolutely. If you were and if you're confident enough about your writing process to not need to check it also. Or you make the sample and you make a second copy identical and you really need to read that one.
But I still don't see any purpose, except for, in training the children's rights fields.
Can you just clarify briefly how you actually map the big zero ones in your machine?
Well, it would take too long to go through the whole process. I can show you how the way we don't do it is the very simple way, which would just be, we're kind of lucky the bits, there's two of them, 0 and 1, and DNA there's 4, which is A, C, G, and T, which happens to be 2 to the power 2. So any two bits, if we imagine breaking the whole story into pairs of bits, we could say, okay, if it's a 0 and a 0, we'll call that A, and a 0 and 1 is C, and 1 and a 0 is G, and a 1, 1 is T. That's A mapping. And then you can take any series of bits, and by splitting it into pairs, and then mapping each pair to a DNA letter, you would get a mapping. Now, you could do that. That's not good enough, because it doesn't allow any error detection or error correction, and it doesn't explain how we go from having a very long series of bits in a large file into short fragments of DNA. So we use a much more complicated system that disallowed repeated DNA letters, and it broke the message into pieces, it used overlapping pieces so there was redundancy, and added the indexing, an indexing system in the coded into the DNA to do that. So there's a lot of elements to it, which would take a whole extra tutorial session, I'm afraid.
Did your rules... I'm sorry.
I'm fine, Tim. No.
Did your rules match nature? I mean, does yours...
No, it doesn't. And in fact, the fact that we allow no repeats at all, I'm quite pleased with hindsight, because that would not happen in nature. In nature, you have plenty of repeated letters all over the place. And the fact that there was a more or less total absence of them, except for errors in hours, would make it, for example, makes it quite clear that it's not biological DNA. So if anyone's ever worried about confusing between, nature's fine. And one of the reasons I, for example, don't worry about whether we're going to create some DNA that will be harmful is that, we're entirely surrounded all our lives by foreign DNA. It's everywhere. It's in all the air that you're each breathing out. My whole body is surrounded by foreign DNA that I mustn't have incorporated into my genome and would be damaging. Living organisms are really good at not being affected by external DNA, even when that's DNA which is damaging to them. In the case of, some forms of viruses, that's their mode of attack. But largely, we're really good at rejecting this. The DNA we're creating does not have the right signals in it to have a biological meaning. It doesn't have the right patterns in there.
It
happens to have been the case. The reason we did that with no repeats was we knew that it would be less error prone in the writing and reading, and afterwards we realised it meant that it was very obviously not biological DNA, and it was unlikely to have any signal that would be interpreted as that could disrupt a biological process in a living sense.
Thank you. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. What intrigues me is the fact, it is a living thing. The data is in a living thing. And as I think we were
mentioning, no, it's not living. Ours is not living. No, DNA is not living.
Right.
Cells are living things.
Right.
Cells are the ones that cells reproduce, and whatever, I think it depends exactly what your definition of life is. DNA is just a bit of chemistry. There are some groups that have thought about putting information in the DNA of the genome of a living cell or a living organism. They're creating all sorts of headaches for themselves involving the ethics of messing with life, the safety of genetically modified organism, and the fact that if you put it in a living thing, it's going to be copied as the cells divide and reproduce, and there will be some level of errors, and the entire history of life on Earth is brought about by the fact that errors happen and changes occur. And what you don't want, if you're trying to store information for a long time, assuming that that's what you want to do, what you don't want is a system that has an error-prone copying process in there. So I think it's not the way to go. We are just using a chemical molecule which happens to have a bunch of convenient features, and which, for other reasons, humans have got very good at handling in the laboratory.
Is it an ingredient of life? Could we say it's an ingredient?
Yeah, you could say that.
We are made up of chemical molecules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as is water, carbohydrate, sugar,
And I mean, you mentioned the horses, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yes, an ingredient. It's one of the chemical compounds.
Yeah.
And it's the one, essentially, the one that used to transmit information through time, cell to cell or generation to generation.
Very good discussion, so thank you very much indeed. If anyone who hasn't already and would like to pay the sub to just cover speakers' meals and refreshments, do feel free, just £1. I will leave it there. I'll just write your name if you do.